So this is Julianne Lyon interviewing Professor Klaus Hutfeld from the University of Bergen, and we're interviewing for the Hidden Histories Project. It is the 11th of July and we're at the Digital Humanities 2014 question. So to 2014 conference. So the first question is, what is your earliest memory in any context of encountering computing or computing technology?
Oh, I remember that very well. That was in the very early 80s, 80, 81 perhaps. And I was a philosophy student at the University of Trondheim, Norway. And across the corridor was the Institute of Continental Shelf Research. And they had computers. And they were accessible to all students. And not many students of humanities were interested, but since it was across the corridor and I had learned from something that you could use these things as typewriters, I sat down by a terminal and somebody came along and taught me how to use it. It was a deck machine with a operating system. I don't remember the name of that. Anyhow, it had a very good text editor. So I learned to use that. They had, you know, it had formatting commands in the old-fashioned way, where if you wanted something to happen to the document, you put a you took a line break and you put a full stop and a code, and then you put it. So if you wanted to italicize a word, it was a full stop, an I, then you the word, and then new line, etc. And then I learned to use macros and made my first experience of writing a login script which contained the command log out, so that I was logged out immediately as soon as I logged on. Very useful experience. So that was my first experience with computers.
And how did you encounter the use of computers in philosophy then, or how did you start having ideas to use computing in this context?
Well, first of all, I wrote my dissertation with computers, but that was not really computation in philosophy. My first encounter was that when I was hired for work on a project which was called the Wittgenstein Project, which was a cooperation between all the then four universities of Norway, the philosophy departments. They had acquired a microfilm copy of Wittgenstein's writings and started and using that, they found that it was very inconvenient because, you know, finding things on a microfilm is kind of hard, difficult. So they got the idea that they should index entries to the microfilm by keywords, and it was so hard for them to agree on keywords that they realized, oh, we might as well try and transcribe the parts we're interested in. And I was hired on that project to transcribe Wittgenstein's writings. And at that time, the transcription was done on a typewriter, and then it was OCR read off-site somewhere. But gradually, since I had learned to use text processing, I started using that instead. So we typed it directly into the machine, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
It's
astonishing to think about those iterations, isn't it, that you almost take for granted?
Yeah.
What would have been your first encounter with the, however we call it, humanities computing of the humanities, the society that we see here? How did you first encounter that wider?
Well, that was when I continued to, later I was fortunate to get a job as leader of that Norwegian Wittgenstein project, and they had already started using some kind of text encoding and written software for doing things with the stuff, and it wasn't finished, so I had to learn programming languages, and I learned to program, and I, with good help from colleagues in computing, I managed to get into the matter.
Did you take formal training?
No formal training.
And how did you go about the process of learning programming?
Well, by then I had moved to Bergen, and the project was situated in something called, well, the Norwegian name was very long, but the Norwegian Computing Center for the Humanities, which was actually established already in 1972 in Bergen. And they had a staff of people who were trained in applying computing to humanities, for example. Learning how to program was something I had never any formal training, but I was introduced by a colleague and then started trying to do things. And in general, I found that it was easy to learn these things if you knew exactly what you wanted to do. So, you know, just like learning a program language coming as part of a formal training with many other students, you learn general stuff and you learn some specifics, but it's not targeted directly to your own needs. But I was very clear about exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to parse this encoding, I wanted to check errors, I wanted to be able to index and to retrieval and all these things. And then I think it was the best way, at least then, of learning programming.
So I guess now might be a good time to ask about the people who particularly influenced you and how and why, and that can be from any of the academic fields.
Mm, yeah. Well, who particularly influenced me in humanities computing? I think that would be hard to say until later in the 80s, when I got in touch with the Text Encoding Initiative and started to take part in working groups and conferences of the Text Encoding Initiative, and that was very, very helpful, and there were lots of people I learned from there. So it's hard to mention anyone in particular at that time.
But the TEI was quite a formative
influence. Yeah.
And what about the Wittgenstein project? At what point did you move? Is it correct to say that you moved away from that at some point?
Yes, but that was much later. This first project was closed because of unclarities concerning copyright, etc. So then I had to earn my living as a computing consultant of sorts at that center for computing in humanities. So I did all sorts of things, such as traveling around the world and preaching the holy gospel of optical storage media, which many people thought to be really the future of computing, etc. Turned out not to be the case, but anyhow. But at the same time, I was unhappy about the fate of the Wittgenstein project that I had been working on, because we had, after all, produced a lot of material, and because of the situation with copyright, etc., not only couldn't we not continue the work, we were not allowed to give access to anyone to the work, and I thought that was just, yeah, too bad. So I worked very hard on establishing a new project, which we call the Wittgenstein Archives. That started formally it started in 1990. And we had an understanding with the Wittgenstein trustees, which were not his in his relatives. He had assigned the copyright to his writings to colleagues in philosophy, so they were philosophers in England and Finland. So we had an agreement with them, and the agreement allowed us to produce what was called a machine-readable version of the Wittgenstein Nachlass. and to publish it in electronic form, but very clearly not to produce anything in book form. And then we got support from the University of Bergen and worked on that for 10 years. We spent exactly 10 years transcribing and finishing all the 20,000 pages of Wittgenstein's Nachlass and published them on Oxford University Press.
Why was it initially that the Nachlass couldn't be published as a book, but it could online? What was the thinking?
It was not that it couldn't technically or legally be published on a book, but there had been attempts at publishing a complete edition in book form for many, many years, and it had never succeeded. And it was made very clear that we did not have the right for book publication, simply because the other project was still going on, and that would have complicated things a lot. And personally, I didn't think that a book edition was a good idea anyhow, so I was not unhappy about that. But it was a lot of work because, you know, this was 1990, so SGML been established in as an ISO standard a few years earlier. The TEI had just begun working. There were no published TEI guidelines yet. I decided not to use SGML for a number of reasons, so I designed a code system or markup language especially for this, which meant that I had to develop all the software, and this was a lot of work. You had to do everything, from programming and markup to design. And
was it chiefly the overlapping hierarchies issue that led you to reject TEI, or was there other factors also?
That was one factor. Another factor was a very simple and trivial fact, namely that no software that I knew of at that time existed for doing the things that we wanted to do with the transcriptions that we produced. And SGML was a very complex system, much more complex than XML. XML, of course, didn't exist at all at that time. So it was a choice. It had to do with overlapping hierarchies and that kind of thing, but it also had to do with the concern that I feared that developing software for SGML, which would be much more difficult than developing software for a system that I had designed myself, and you know, I could adapt the system too, so it was all I had it all in my own control, so to speak. So that was also a reason. I think if I had started such a project today, I would not have done it that way. Then we would probably have used XML, but it was a very different situation. But we spent 10 years on this, and then we had we published the entire collected works on CD at Oxford University Press, and I thought by then that this had been a very interesting, wonderful time. I was thankful that I had the chance to do this work, but 15 years of Wittgenstein was, you know, time to do something else. But the Wittgenstein Archive still exists, which is a little bit paradoxical, you might say, because the whole reason for doing this work was that to make the writings accessible. So there would not be necessary for scholars to travel to the to see the originals in Cambridge and in the Austrian National Library and a couple of manuscripts in Canada as well. And now it is accessible electronically, but still people keep going to Bergen, because I think it's simply because it has become a center for Wittgenstein research, and you know, people travel there to see people, other people. Also, I should say, if we had done this today, well, even then, we wanted to make the source material freely available on the internet. I mean, even the web didn't exist when we started this project. But we had thought of that. That's what we ideally wanted to do. But it was out of the question because the copyright holders did not want to let that happen. And because of the contract, etc., it's still not possible. All their parts of the Nachlass is never available on the web.
And did Wittgenstein himself leave those instructions, or?
He left no real instructions. He said in his will that he gave the copyright in all his unpublished manuscripts to, the four people mentioned, to publish and dispose of as they think fit.
Okay.
That was 1951.
The type of investment in time and effort that went into building, it was MEX, wasn't it?
Yes.
The name of the land.
Yes.
And the software all around it. What kind of was this a huge investment of your time? And
it was a huge investment of my time, yes. Yes.
How was it funded and justified within the project? Were you quite free to use your time?
Yes.
You were the boss, basically, or?
Yes.
So there was no.
I was given very free hands, and that's one of the reasons why I'm thankful. I mean, it was a lot of work to establish the project, lots of formalities and all that. But once it got started, I was given very free hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very good.
So when you moved on from the Wittgenstein project, did you go straight to a professorship, or how did this?
I became an associate professor of the Department of Philosophy in 1994. But of course, I didn't really start working in a normal position at the department until this project was finished in 2000. Actually, that's not true. For a couple of years, I was acting director of the Humanities Computing Center in Bergen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I decided that there. That's too much. That was fun too. Sorry, lots of fun. But I had come to an age that I realized that if I go on doing this kind of management work, I can never go back to do research. So I had to make a choice. And so I picked up the position which I had formerly had at the Department of Philosophy for 8 years already in 2002. And since then I have been teaching philosophy and been fortunate enough to be able to teach also humanities computing in Bergen.
What about the perceptions of scholars and of fellow philosophers who weren't using computing or computers in their research? Could you reflect a bit on the types of reception that your work received in the broader community, beyond? How people reacted to it, to the use of computing. Was it something novel at that stage?
Within philosophy, both locally and as far as I could tell, globally, the application of computing to philosophy was largely regarded with some skepticism, and even sometimes you could encounter some hostility. But that was also at the time when there was a lot of talk about artificial intelligence in connection with computing and all that. And we were not doing that kind of thing, of course. But it was among Wittgenstein scholars, this was regarded with at least positive anticipation. I mean, people had wanted to have access to. There was a certain skepticism towards, whether an electronic edition could ever substitute a real collected publications in book form. But apart from that, there was no problem.
And the transition that you made from, so you mentioned you were working in the computing center, and then you got an assistant associate professor role. How did you find that transition? Was it?
Well, I found that quite stimulating to me because, as I said, I had been working so hard and so concentratedly, so narrowly focused on the Wittgenstein edition stuff for so many years that it was nice to be able to do something different, and it was also very good for me to, you know, do philosophy proper again. And there was some interest from both students and other colleagues trying to integrate this. My interest, even after having worked with Wittgenstein for such a long time, was not primarily Wittgenstein's philosophy. It was the philosophical problems that could arise from aspects of the work that we were doing, such as trying to represent a document in another form, and the semantics of the whole operation, and the kinds of cognitive processes that are involved, and the criteria for judging, etc. Also the role of technology in our relation to the written word. These were issues that interested me a lot. So we organized some seminars along those lines, and that was quite interesting.
I just want to, I'm sort of conscious of your time, but I want to make sure I get through my core questions at least. So it's often, so people, when I do these interviews, people often reflect to me that about their first engagement with the conference community and the type of society that they found there. And would you talk about that a bit, your sort of impressions and...
Yes, one of the things that struck me was that, first of all, I was very struck by the fact that philosophers were so, with exceptions, but in general, so completely unconcerned about the status of the text as an object of study. And of course, text is not the object of study in philosophy, but what is it? Whatever it is transmitted through text. I mean, philosophy is a discipline which is performed almost entirely in language. You know, you talk, you listen, you read, you write. That's what you do as a philosopher. And then experiencing that when faced with the fact that what they had been working with for years, a published edition of Wittgenstein's writings, had a problematic status in relation to what Wittgenstein actually wrote. That it had been heavily edited, that editors had selected passages and suppressed others, etc. That was something that was completely unknown to them. And it seemed to me also to most people, it didn't concern them. There was little interest. So that struck me as very paradoxical. But then, of course, I found that this has to do with the philosophical traditions too, mainly English American analytic philosophy, which is, to a large extent, a systematic, problem-oriented discipline. The attitude is that, you know, the author is not of interest here; it's the problems. And well, if Wittgenstein wrote, what Wittgenstein wrote was in some details different from what's actually been published, well, we could look at it and see if it gives us some interesting philosophical new aspects or ideas, but what we are working is on the basis of the published text. That's an independent object, and then, you know, these considerations are not relevant. Whereas in continental, especially German tradition, is much more oriented historically towards, and they have a lot of editorial work. So that made me aware of things I hadn't known. That was useful. But so that's, you know, the role of text technology and philosophy itself. But apart from that, it's been one of my hobby horses or my concerns that I found it, and I still find it, very puzzling that the communities, the research communities, which one would think were those who had the highest expertise concerning ways of working with text, both how it can be done today and how it's been done historically and how to relate to historic documents, etc., have almost no role to play in the development of modern text technology. So one of my hobby horses has always been that we as humanity scholars should not sit there at the end of the production line and being passive recipients of tools like text analysis or text editors and things like that. It doesn't seem to have changed much. I mean, of course, humanities scholars develop their own tools for doing their own research, but they have, I mean, I don't know that there are many or any commercially successful products that in which experts from the field of philology have had any leading hand in the design and the in the basic representational structures, etc. So that still puzzles me.
Yeah, now that you, I had never thought about it before, but now that you said yes, it's extremely odd, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You think that, yeah. I also wanted to ask about the society, about the nature of the community that you encountered. So people often say to me that the humanities computing community tended to be very welcoming,
yes,
and very open, and that there's kind of some have said excessively so, and that stood often in stark contrast to their home discipline, so to speak, which could be characterized by sort of territorial behavior at conferences and so on.
Yeah.
What do you think? Would you agree, disagree? What's your opinion on that?
Yes. Yeah, I haven't thought so much about that, but yes, I think it's true. I mean, the project that I worked on for so many years, the Wittgenstein Archives, wasn't there primarily as a result of the collective pressure from the Department of Philosophy, so to speak. It was there, it came into being because there were very few enthusiasts, and some of them were very good at maneuvering in the university so I guess I have the same experience, you might say, but it's never really struck me as a problem, and partly also because I have never really been able to relate to the idea of digital humanities or humanities computing as some kind of discipline. I mean, it's natural in a way that if you're using the same tools in your work and you can help each other, then you have very practical affinities. Whereas if you are perhaps also because it's not been so academically established, there is little of the kind of competition that you find within the established disciplines. You know, if you have a good idea about something, then you'd better write it up and lock it up in your drawer so that and don't mention it until you've got it published. There's very little of that in this community.
Okay, so two more questions on the end, and I'll let you go to make sure you get there on time. So the first is, it's fair to say that you don't see digital humanities as a discipline, but as a sort of convergence of interested tools.
Yeah,
And so have you seen, so your time in the field, have you seen that change or go through different cycles of development?
Yes, and I have seen, I think through the years there has been an ongoing and endless discussion about digital humanities and what's its status and identity and all that. You know, that's not in a way so surprising, because there is always also the endless debate of what the humanities are and the crisis of the humanities, etc. And when you've been around for a while, you get used to that. The crisis cannot be a crisis because it's been going on for at least the 30 years that I have been in the humanities. But at the same time, there is seems to be now, during the last few years, you know, larger emphasis not so much on the tools and methods, but of studies of the consequences to society and culture of the introduction of new technology, and to the ethical aspects. And I'm a little bit worried about that, because, I mean, again, it gives humanists a role in relation to technology as servants or as users. So very often, as soon as there is a question of involving humanities in some kind of non-core humanities activity, we are set to look at the cultural consequences and the ethical aspects. Of course, as humanists, we can do that, but we can do much more. We can contribute to the development of the technology itself and be there in the process of deciding what are useful aims to work for, etc. And that's, I think that's going in the wrong direction now.
Mm.
That worries me a little bit.
Okay, so the final question is about any disappointments you might have about the limitations of computing, either in relation to Wittgenstein or philosophy in general, I guess, or your area of interest.
Disappointments?
Yeah.
No, I don't really think so, because I have never had so high expectations. I mean, we used computers to collect data, to analyze data, to massage them in various ways. We have never, or at least I have never had high hopes in terms of you know, computer-supported philosophical analysis. What would that be? No. So I'm fortunate. Not too high expectations,
yes.
And no disappointments.
Okay. Well, that sounds like quite a nice note to end on. So thank you.
Okay.